Remember, we're still within the area of the home life, since both servant and master were part of the home. And chapters 3:22 through 4:1, very important to understand something about the background of life in the Roman Empire in order to see what Paul is teaching. And the first area that is important is to keep in mind the social conditions that existed in the Roman Empire at the time that this letter was written. In the first place, the economy had been tremendously depleted because of wars. And as a result, you had emerging three different groups of people. First of all, the majority of the population was made up of slaves. That would be by far the majority. There were a few employers or proprietors. But by and large, this was the mass, the slave group, and also the lowest social status, as we'll see in just a moment. And also you had the employers, and of course there were very few of them. Then you had a third group that had been quite significant. It is that in the time of the writing of these New Testament epistles, you had a group of, large group of returning soldiers. They did produce some problems in the Roman Empire, mainly because they were free men, and they simply refused to do the activity of a slave. And therefore, basically, if you worked, or if you were idle, indicated just exactly where you stood as far as the social status was concerned. If you worked, that was the sign of slavery. If, however, you were idle, that was the sign of your aristocracy. That is why in Paul's letters you have, especially in 22:23, an emphasis in 22, servants. And then verse 23, whatever you do, do heartily as unto the Lord. In other words, an underscoring of work. And you also have a stress on that particular type of activity because it was not popular. That basically made up the social conditions. You also had social classes coming out of this. And you could hardly miss it when you see Paul saying slaves and then saying masters. And the classes basically look like this. The dividing line simply was, are you owned or are you owner? Up here would be the owners or proprietors. That was the basic issue. These were the owners. What profession you were had nothing to do with your social status. You could be highly trained and be cleared out of the bottom as far as social status was concerned, because the issue was not how educated you are, how cultured you are. The issue is, do you own or are you owned? So you had the proprietors up here, and then finally down below, you had three other classes. One class we'll simply call the people that were paid for their services, or hirelings. Basically, the hirelings took in all your professions. This could be the doctor, the dentist, the trash man, and a carpenter. If you worked for anybody, there is probably the class you would be in. You also had a large class, and we're descending now into social status. Proprietors would be the highest, then the hirelings would be down here, which means you could be below this line in the lower classes of the Roman Empire and have 8 PhDs, and you could be up here and have gone to first grade. Because the issue was not education, it was not culture, is are you owned or are you owner? So owners would be up here, then the major division into the rest of the empire would be hirelings and the rabble. And there was a significant amount of rabble, and then finally down to the last would be the slaves. And the important thing would be the slaves were the lowest socially, but not culturally. They were the lowest socially, not culturally. In other words, you had some very refined, educated, smart slaves. But nonetheless, irrespective of what you were culturally, you were still the bottom of the list. Now, this group up here was fairly significant. Basically, these were the welfare people. And they did either one of two things. They gathered around cities, and their occupation basically was to be thieves, or to simply live off the country, or many of them gambled. Let me show you this class. Acts chapter 17, verse 5. Any city, had this group in them in the Roman Empire. They usually were in the inner part of the cities. They would be around the marketplace. Acts chapter 17. Acts 17 in the King James gives a translation to these rabble groups that gathered in the marketplace. Something that, a translation that you'll never forget. This is our vile fellows of the baser sort. But at any rate, in verse 5, the Jews who believed not moved with envy. Now we're in the city of Thessalonica. And Thessalonica was not a large place, but nonetheless, Thessalonica had its marketplace. If you had your marketplace, you had your rabble, the people that either that were down there to gamble or thieve or whatever. So the Jews who believed not moved with envy, took them certain vile fellows of the baser sort. Actually, the Greek and your New American has got it very well. It says evil men from the marketplace. And it was simply referring to the rabble. Evil men from the marketplace and gathered a company and set all the city in uproar. Which means you could go down to the sort of the inner city area of Thessalonica, gather together this rabble, and if you wanted to make a commotion and just upset the city, gather them together and march. And so you had this group present in the Roman Empire. Now, Paul is now talking about the relationship of this group up here to this group down here. How should the slaves, incidentally, most of Christianity came from right down here. Christianity in the first century was made up of the lowest social class of people. Remember, 1 Corinthians 1 calls that to our attention. He says, notice how God has chosen the baser forms of baser ones and so forth to glorify himself, 1:26 down through verse 31. So that basically we're looking at the masses of Christianity that centered down here, and some were saved who were up here. And Paul is now going to talk about how does this group relate to the group up on top. Now, the first, or one other thing I just want to say by way of introduction, after the conditions and the classes in the Roman Empire, is what is the biblical stance on slavery? Two things we can say. One, as far as the condition of slavery is concerned, it does not state approval of it. That much is clear. It does not state approval. However, a second thing is also clear. It does not permit revolt. It does not permit revolt. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even suggest reform. And you can see that clearly from the passage in Colossians. What does he say? Servants, obey. What is he doing? He's looking at the structure of slavery, and he says, while I'm not approving it, at the same time, I do not permit revolt. In fact, I don't even advocate resistance against it. I'm saying to you, go along with that system. Now, you can say, well, why would he do that? And here's a very important thing to remember. Why would Paul not say slavery is wrong? Why would he not encourage throwing that type of thing off? Why would he say, go along with it? Here's the answer, and it's a very important one to grasp. Because being a slave was no disadvantage whatsoever in living the Christian life. And therefore, if it is no disadvantage in living the Christian life, therefore, Paul makes no suggestions whatsoever in terms of throwing it off. In other words, and I realize in the 20th century to say this is to be on the wrong side of the fence, but basically, God looks at the master-slave situation, he says, no problem. Of course, we would be all heated up over the thing today. You mean there's a master and somebody that owns him? There's a slave? That ought to be changed in the name of Christianity. Well, God just isn't bothered with it. God simply says, if you're a slave, obey. And if you're a master, be fair. So that, basically, there is absolutely no way that we could stretch the New Testament to say it's the least bit concerned with social conditions. And when you think today of the emphasis you get in many churches, what is the idea, the function of the church is to get out there and change society, isn't it? We're to reform it, and our activities to be social. And yet, when you come to the epistles, and I repeat what I just said, there is absolutely no concern whatsoever about changing the social conditions of the Roman Empire. Now that ought to say something to us. Now, the thing it ought to say to us is that the emphasis is not on the changing of social conditions. What is the emphasis? The emphasis in all the epistles is transforming men. Doesn't make any difference who in the world they are, on or owned. The issue is training and turning those men into the likeness of Christ. Now, Paul does say, and it's a very important thing to grasp, the biblical stance is, what do you do for these owned people? And here's a very important concept to grasp, and it's simply this. God's word does not free the slave in any way. God's word does not free the slave. Here's what it does. It gives him new motivation. When it looked at the social condition in the Roman Empire, the answer of the Apostle Paul was not revolt. It was give them new motivation. And those are the words to be underscored. Giving the slave a brand new reason for doing it. For example, reading in verse 22, notice how he does this. The motive is different. Servants, stick with the system. Obey in all things your masters according to the flesh. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God, and whatever you slaves do in obedience to your masters, do it heartily, and here's the brand new motive, as unto the Lord. So what does he do? He looks at the social structure of the Roman Empire that had the masters that owned and the slaves that served, and it says, I do not advocate rebellion. I do not permit resistance of the slave against his master. Here's what I do. I demand that the slave obey his master. Here's what I give you, however, a brand new motivation. You can obey a master as unto the Lord, which means they could continue in their obedience as slaves, and it would still be directly as unto the Lord. All right, let's take then the details of the verses and follow through with the outline last week. I think we're about Roman numeral 5, and that was relationship of servants to masters. Relationship of servants to masters. If you have the question in mind, am I saying that I have no concern for social conditions? Yes. Couldn't care less. The issue is men coming to relationship in Jesus Christ and living as unto the Lord. Why? Social conditions don't affect your Christian life. Now, if you're free, are you glad for it? Sure. Very thankful for it. Would you want to keep it? By all means. And yet at the same time, that isn't even the issue. The issue is living the Christian life, and our social status has nothing to do with that. All right, verse 22. Servants, obey in all things your masters. Now, we're going to kind of outline this in terms of making a little analogy, because the basic problem that is involved in these verses is what we'll call muscle and management. As far as the muscle was concerned, it was obviously down with the slave class. Could they revolt? Could they outnumber the management or the master group? No question about that. And it's a matter of muscle versus management. Now, let me also add one other thing. The master-servant relationship is not the same as employer-employee relationship, but there are similarities. Let me repeat that once again. The servant-master relationship is not identical to employer-employee relationship, but there are some very definite similarities between the two. And therefore, in going through this passage of master and servant, you can't just slough it off and say, well, we don't have masters and servants around anymore. Therefore, what does verses 22 through chapter 4, verse 1 mean? Not a thing. Who owns a slave in this room tonight? Anybody? What, employees, okay. We'll get to that. We're coming to them. In the sense of ownership, we don't have any here tonight. So that reason, we ought to jump then from verse 21 down to chapter 4 and verse 2. Does it mean anything for us? It should. And what we'll emphasize is that the basic problem involved was on the part of muscle and management. And make some analogy, though this does not overlap at all points. There is an analogy between employer-employee relationship. And we'll emphasize what those are as we go throughout it. All right, servants, obey in all things your masters. And the important word there is the word master. Master is kurios. Whenever you read in the Bible about the Lord Jesus Christ, the word for Lord is kurios. And it's translated in this verse, verse 22, and also in chapter 4, verse 1, it's the word meaning Lord, or usually translated Lord. And the idea of Lord is, of course, the idea of a master idea. Now, haven't management and muscle always had problems? Hasn't there always been management over here, workers over here, and what is the solution to the problem of management and workers? What is the biblical relationship between the two? Because it certainly exists. And in the passage, we'll see some of the answer to it. The basic answer to the problem of muscle and management is in one word. The answer is reciprocity. Would that not help? To reciprocate means give and take. And the answer lies in the give and take. Is there responsibility of the servant? Yes. Is there responsibility of the master? Yes. What is the solution to the two getting along? Both assuming the responsibility given. Now, what are the two responsibilities? If we put servant on the right or left, or, and in parentheses under it, employee. And over here, master. Or, by way of application, employer. Now, what is the relationship between the two? The world's answer from the master's standpoint is absolute domination of whoever you can dominate on the labor force and manipulate any way you can, pay as little as you can, and get away with it. That is evil. There is an evil on the other side that is current with us, and that is the evil of a labor union. And I guess I might as well put the cards on the table. A labor union is evil. You say, well, it's brought about some good things. That isn't even the issue. It is biblically evil for employees ever to gather together to put pressure on management. Always. And we'll see that from a parable in the Gospels a little bit later on. So then, what is going to be the answer? The answer is not organization here or organization here. The answer is responsibility of the servant, responsibility of the master. And over here on the part of the servant, you have two things required. One, dependability. And two, effort. Dependability, verse 22. Obey in all things your masters, not just when he is looking. That's what the idea is involved in eye service. When the boss's eye is on you, not just when he is looking. So the idea is you owe dependability. And in verse 23, you owe effort. And that is, whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord. Now, over on this side, there's responsibility in 4:1. Masters, give unto your servants that which is just. The responsibility of management is justice. And King James has fairness. Justice and fairness. Now, let me ask this. If both management and the labor over here, if both fulfill those responsibilities, where's your problem? Wouldn't have any, would you? Would there be any problem of working for a person who was absolutely just and fair? Any problem with that, would there? On the other hand, would there be any problem with an employee that was dependable and put forth effort? And therefore, you have a perfect answer between the two as far as the word is concerned. Now, Paul moves into a listing of what are the duties of the slaves and then the duties of the master. Well, let's list duties of... let's use the word employer, employee. and we'll put them down in terms of principles. Number one, the first duty of the employee is execution of the job requirements set by the employer. Execution of job requirements of employer. 22A. Servants, and notice he is now spelling out their duty, obey. The term obey we had last week, it's the same term that's used back in verse 20, where it says, children, obey your parents. It is the word hupakuo. And remember, we emphasize that it's a listening word. Akuo means to listen. And the hupa on the front is under. It's the idea of submissive listening, or the kind of listening that obeys. And therefore, it is to listen under, to listen submissively, or, very well translated, is to obey. Tense, mood, and voice. Tense, present, do it all the time. Mood, imperative, you don't have any choice. Voice, active, mean you do it. You produce that action. So servants, then, paraphrase, servants, you produce the action, it is imperative, and do it all the time of obedience. And then notice incidentally in here, when you look at the master saying, here is what I want you as the slave to do, what biblically are you supposed to do? Four-letter word, isn't it? Obey. And what does that say? Execution of the requirements of the employer. Now, this is assuming, of course, that they're not violating Scripture, requirements that are of a legitimate nature. So that sort of is saying that over here on the employee side, employees definitely ought to have a say, shouldn't they, in what management asks for? No. What is the responsibility? Obey. You say, well, they're nuts. It's not your problem. Not at all. If you say, well, the policy's bad. That's not your problem. Policy making is on the management end. Execution of it is on the employee end. You say, well, what if the employee doesn't like it? Well, it's an employee relationship. Quit. But you cannot fight it biblically. Biblically, there's a recognition of the execution of the job or requirements set by the employer, and there is no policy setting at all on the part of labor. Let's look at that in a parallel passage, Matthew 20, where Christ gave a parallel dealing with this same concept. As far as a master-slave relationship is concerned, now it could have been very conceivable in a situation that a master would ask advice of a servant. If that's the case, fine. But the general pattern, he gives the orders, the servants carry them out. You say, well, that would have been galling. I would have quit. Well, no, you couldn't do that either, because you couldn't say, I resign being a servant. You are property. So they didn't have that option. Notice in Matthew 20, you have a parable given by the Lord that definitely has to do with, what about management and labor when it comes to salary? Don't you think that if a man puts in 2 hours and another man puts in 4 and they get paid the same, that that's a rotten deal? And all the guys that get paid less than the others do ought to strike? No, not biblically. Matthew 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man that is a householder, this would be management, who went out early in the morning to hire laborers in his vineyard. So notice the context of what he's talking about is extremely clear. He's talking about employer-employer relationship in terms of money. So he went out in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. So we've got householder and laborers. Management, who's going to do the paying, and the laborers, who are going to do the laboring and are going to be paid. And verse 2, when he had agreed with the laborers, let's put down these, we've got really 6 or 5 groups here that he's going to deal with. And then we're going to be asked a question. So group 1 through 5. Group 1 is in verse 2. When he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them to his vineyard. So the first thing is, this first group of laborers agreed on his terms. The important thing to note all the way through, nobody got dragged into the vineyard. He didn't go in there and handcuff them and say, you're going to be chained out here to my cherry tree and you're going to pick cherries. He simply went to the marketplace and said, I will pay one penny or a denarius for a day's labor. That incident was roughly what a day's labor brought about in those times. And notice in verse 2, they responded and they went to the vineyard. Now what's the issue? They agreed on his terms. They didn't go on the end of a gun. They went because he said, I'll pay you that much, and at the end of the day, he's going to do so. Now, the second group comes down in the following verses, verse 3. When he went out the third hour, notice we're getting into the day now, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said to them, go also into the vineyard, and whatever is right, I will give you. Notice he doesn't say what it is, but whatever is right, I will give you. And at gunpoint, they went to the vineyard. No, he just said, I'll do what's right. Now, they had the option to say, I think you're a crook. Or they could have said, what's right? How much is that? But they didn't, did they? They did the same thing. They agreed on his terms. Now, he's responsible to be fair, true. But at the same time, again, they went to the vineyard on the agreement, which was what? I'll give you what's right. Then you have the next group, and again, this essence is getting later in the day. Verse 5, he went out the sixth hour, and he went out the ninth hour and did the same. So we got groups 3 and 4, and now verse 6, you've got about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle and said to them, why you stand here all day idle? They said to him, because no man's hired us. He says, go also into the vineyard, whatever is right, you'll receive. So what's the whole point? He made terms, and they entered into an agreement. Now, at the end of the day, verses 8 and 9, he gave the paychecks out. Verse 8 says, so when evening was come, the lord of the vineyard says to his steward, call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the first to the last. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a denarius. Now, can you see the problem? The guys that sweat all day long are going to say, hey, you can't do that. That's not fair. And let me ask you, in the mentality of the 20th century, does it strike you the same way? Notice their case, verse 10. But when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more. And they likewise received every man a denarius. So the people that worked for an hour got a denarius. The people that worked all day long got a denarius. And verse 11, you have labor murmuring. When they had received it, they murmured against the householder, saying, these last have worked 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us, who have borne the burden and the heat of the day. Now, stopping right there, wouldn't you say, from 20th century way of thinking, you'd say, hey, you guys are right. No, they're not. Why not? Did group one get what they agreed on? They got the denarius, didn't they? Did the rest get what they agreed on? They agreed to go for whatever's right, didn't they? Every single one of the five groups got what they agreed on, and notice that's his answer. Verse 13, he says, he answered and said, friend, I did you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? That's group one. And what's the answer? You agreed for a denarius. Take what's yours, go your way. I will give unto this last, even as unto thee. And here is the principle that is really involved, which is down at verse 15. Is it not lawful to me to do what I will with mine own? In other words, I've got to keep my agreement. No question. I agreed for the denarius. So I paid group 2, 3, 4, and 5 as much as I paid you. Are you telling me that I don't have the right to pay out of my pocket the way I want to? You get the idea that he's getting across? If I want to give him 5 denarius, isn't that his right? And so he's emphasizing that if you got what was agreed upon, you can't counter with the argument, well, they didn't work as hard as I do, and therefore we're going to pick it. Notice verse 15, he points out again to that group, he says, is your eye evil? That's the idea for jealousy. Because I am generous, And so the idea was, he kept his agreement, and with groups 2, 3, 4, and 5, he was more than that. He was generous on top of it. So the emphasis is the idea that whatever is agreed upon is the issue, and they had no right. What they were trying was a little case of what? Collective bargaining. Hey, we sweat all day long. Don't we have the right to get a little bit more out of you? And his answer is very emphatic, is that no, you do not. And of course, the principle is that they do not. Okay, back to our passage. Colossians. Colossians 3:22. Servants, obey in all things your masters. Now notice, in order to make emphatic that they are to execute the requirements of the employer, he now brings in, what is the extent of it? Aren't you supposed to filter through what management asks and do only what you think is best? No, they didn't have that option either, because it's obey in all things, and in all things emphasizes the principle that is involved. All right, principle number one, then, execution of the job requirements of the employer, wrapped up in the word obey in all things. The second concept is execution, and here's the key to it, execution of the job as unto the Lord. That is the key to the motivation of the slave in this passage. Now notice this has to a negative aspect and it's got a positive aspect. Obey in all things your masters. Why would he put according to the flesh on there? Simply because if the master is a believer, what's your relationship? If the master is a believer, your brothers in Christ. And so he's emphasizing your masters according to the flesh. In other words, this is not a spiritual relationship, but due to their flesh relationship. Then the negative part, not with eye service. Now, what is the idea of not with eye service? What is eye service? All Paul has done is taken the word for eye and put it with the word for servant. When you have eye problems, you go to the ophthalmologist, and the word in Greek is ophthalma, and then the word for servant is dulia or doulos. So ophthalmos, eye, and doulos has to do with service. Again, even when you see the way the Greek word is made up, you still have got the same thing you have in translation. What does eye service mean? Two ideas are connected with it. Eye service, first of all, carries the idea is, don't obey just when the master's eye is on you. Don't serve well just when his eye is on you. In other words, as a Christian employee, it shouldn't take the watchful eye of the boss for you to do an efficient, effective, hard job. The second idea that's sometimes involved with the word ophthalmodulia is the idea is service done to catch somebody's eye. And the word is used in both ways. It's used of doing a job just because you're being watched, and it's also used of doing a job because you want to catch the eye. In other words, it's the idea of if you empty the wastebasket, be sure that you make enough noise coming down the hall so when you pass the office door, you'll be noticed. And it's the idea of you're serving in order to catch the eye type of idea. Now, why would both of these things be wrong? A believer is not to execute his job as an employee just because he's being watched. And he's not to do it to catch human eye. Both of these things reveal what? Both of these things, if their motives, tell a story. And what's the story they tell? They tell who you're doing it for. And that violates who we're supposed to do it for, which is the Lord. And notice he develops that in the latter part of verse 22. Not with eye service, that is to attract attention, and not just when you're being watched, as men pleasers. So if we're doing it as unto the employer, then we're a men pleaser. But, and here's our positive part, the positive part is in singleness of heart. The word for singleness, heplates, carries two ideas with it. One is anything that is simple and anything that is sincere. Really, the word carries both. In fact, a little way to get around the fact that sincerity and simplicity are very much involved with one another. But so you do it in simplicity and sincerity of heart, fearing God. So what's the idea? Responsibility, execution of the job requirements of the employer. Obey all things. Execution of that, and again, now he's going to take, you could say, with that first one, and again, due to our strong sense of independence and individuality that a lot of us have in America, that top one does kind of grate, doesn't it? You mean, I don't have any voice in the policy, and those nuts up there in the front office who don't know what's going on are going to tell me what to do, and I'm supposed to do it? Now, that's right. You say, well, I just can't do that because I can't stand management. That shows where your motivation is. Why are we supposed to do it? As unto the Lord, not as unto men. And therefore, the motivation is, that does bring something down to a very simple concept. Do you mean the guy that comes out and picks up trash does that as unto the Lord? Can you pick up trash for the Lord? Of course not. That's secular. You can only teach a Sunday school class for the Lord. Only a pastor is doing it for the Lord. Everybody else is involved in what? Secular work. What's Paul saying? He's saying, look, you can pick apples for the Lord. You can rivet rivets if they had them, or you can put chariot wheels on, or for that matter, you can pour manure all over the pasture, or pick it up in a basket if that's the requirement, and still say, this is done for God. Now, in the light of that, in verse 22, what is Christian service as over against anything else? There isn't anything else, is there? Everything that the believer, there is no such thing as full-time Christian service separate from anything else. Every believer does everything he does as unto the Lord. And in the light of this verse, I would take it that if it's done as unto the Lord, that what you have done today in terms of whatever your job was, as long as it's legal, if that's what you've done today, that is just as sacred as anything that anybody could ever do. And that does help relieve a lot of tension, because so often you get a little bit of a guilt complex. Well, I'm over here driving rivets and really ought to be serving the Lord. What's that saying about driving the rivets? It's not being done as unto the Lord. And this is exactly what Paul is driving at. So that he expands it now in the following verse. Verse 23, and whatever you do. Now, we always make application of this, you know, to usually out of context. The ye in verse 23 is who? It's the servant. Whatever you do as a servant, whatever that thing might be, do it heartily. All right, there is our third principle then in terms of work. And the third principle is execution of the job by doing as much as possible, as well as possible. Doing as much as possible, as well as possible. Now, why would we want to do that? And the answer ought to be very simple. Who are we doing it for? If everything can be done for the Lord, then in the light of His greatness, shouldn't we do as much as possible, as well as we can? And notice that's spelled out in verse 23. Whatever you do, do it heartily. Heartily translates exukēs. Ek, remember, out of, usually as a source. Psuche is your soul. And the soul is the innermost seat of life. Now, again, I notice both King James and New American have opted for heartily on that. I don't like that. Maybe it does get it across. You're doing it out of your very inner being, or doing it out of your soul. Heartily, to me, I can't get away from Santa Claus's laugh is hearty, and some people eat hearty, and that's all I can think of with that word, so I can't even use it. The idea is you are doing everything you can. You are whole soul in the thing, and the source is your inner life. And I would paraphrase it by saying, you're doing as much as possible. You're doing it out of your soul, and you're doing it as well as possible. Doing your best, and you're doing it from your innermost being. Execution of the job, doing as much as possible, as well as possible. So, as unto the Lord, and not unto men. Notice again the stress on motive. No indication, sorry you're a slave. Why? You can function as a slave and honor God. What else counts? That's the whole issue. The whole issue is the only thing that counts is honoring God, and therefore nothing else is really of that great importance. Fourth principle. You say, now, and just by extending your reasoning a little bit, if we are doing everything we do as unto the Lord, and He is our master, and He is going to give us the ultimate paycheck, have a little question. Do you think He'll be fair if we do it as unto Him? Do you think He'll come, or do you think He'll short us a little bit? All right, that is the last or fourth important point, and that is execution of the job as to God. And the important thing, the totally just one. All right, this comes down to verse 24. Now here's the doctrine that we have behind these principles concerning work. Knowing that of the Lord you shall receive the reward, namely, the inheritance. Ultimately, as things are done unto Him, He is going to be the giver of the reward, which will be an inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. And that means, if you serve the Lord, you can't serve a master. Verse 22, servants, obey in all things your masters. Verse 24, you serve the Lord Christ. What is He saying? That behind your service to the master for a believer is a brand new motivation. So that he could go to work and execute what the employer required, and the employee could come by and say, thank you for doing the job, and you could say, that's fine, I wasn't doing it for you in the first place. And that's the whole emphasis. Verse 25. Let's suppose, however, that we decide, well, employer is wrong, corny policy, and I'm going to do a halfway job. Well, notice there is the negative aspect. Not only is He just in giving the reward for those that are obedient to the proceeding, but he that does wrong shall receive for the wrong which he has done. Remember this, God doesn't play favorites. So notice it puts a very, very serious viewpoint in terms of our work. And again, just think of these principles. And I know it's Wednesday evening, and the last thing someone who's worked 8 hours a day wants to think about on Wednesday evening is Thursday morning. But it does apply to our work. Stop and think about it. I don't care what you do. I'm just assuming it's legal. Whatever you do, if you're employed, responsibility, execute the requirements of the employer. Corny policy, poor policy, doesn't make a difference. He's the one that's going to lose money on it, not you. You're still getting your salary, unless he's too corny. Execution of the requirements of it. Key term, obey in all things. Management makes the policy. Labor does not make the policy. Very simple. Now, when that is done, in other words, because the mechanics, here's the guy wants a screw put in over here, he wants a nail put in over here. Okay, that's a mechanic, I'll do that. But as I pound the nail in the wall, I am doing it as unto the Lord. And as I pound it in the wall, I'm going to pound it in with one solid stroke if I can. I'm not going to fiddle around between a coffee cup and something else, because if we do, what are we saying? We're saying, well, I'm not doing this for the Lord anyway. And we're saying part of our life is secular, and we're denying that we do all things as unto the Lord. And therefore, the failure to do a job well and do as much as possible. Hey, is there any reason why, if you pick up the trash, do you think, as a pastor teacher, I'll get more reward than you will? No way. If it is done as unto the Lord. execution of the job as well as possible and as much as possible because of for whom we're doing it. And then, of course, recognizing as we execute that job as unto the Lord, what about him and his pay? Is he going to be fair? Ultimately, we get the inheritance because he's the totally just one. Now, on the other hand, you have responsibility on the part of the master. Chapter 4, verse 1. This is the duty of employer. Two sides to the coin. Employee side, employer side. Number one, the chief principle as far as management concern is what? Masters, give unto your servants that which is just. So we'll put it down in sort of a paraphrase. Management is to recognize the right of the employee to fair pay. He is not to say, well, if I can get him cheap, I will. The idea is to be a recognition that if he puts forth compensation, there ought to be, if he puts forth effort, there ought to be a fair compensation on my part. And it is certainly just as wrong for an employer to try to be unfair to an employee as it is for an employee to violate the principles we just looked at in the preceding context. So that he is not to profit by unfair treatment of a servant in terms of compensation. And compensation is the emphasis of verse 1 because it's given to your servant. It's the idea of the paycheck. That which is just and fair. Not out of that. Give unto your servants. Yeah, not out of the just and fair. Masters, give to your servants. And probably the reason, I'm using compensation there rather than money is that they compensated in various ways. They could compensate with coinage. They could compensate with oil. Grain was a form of wealth. Garments were a form of wealth. All of that was involved, and consequently, the compensation could involve various type things. Much like today, you know, I would certainly be rather paid in oil and grain than dollars. All right. Master, given your servants that which is fair, just, and equal, and usually the term is be fair. Fairness and recognition to right of compensation. And what ought to motivate him? Is the employer or the master really the master? Not really. You can't get high enough on the pole, but what you say, there's one above. And that is the latter part, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. So the motivation is your answerability to God. And again, what is the solution of the relationship of the two? Very. You know, it's really, I got a lot of amusement in reading through the commentaries on this little section, how every commentator spends so much time trying to get Paul out of a crack. You know, here's this guy telling servants to obey their masters when all of that is so evil, and they spend half of the commentary saying, now Paul didn't really. Looks like he did, doesn't it? Servants, obey in all things your masters. He is not fighting the system. Why? It doesn't make any difference. The issue is, whatever we do may be done as unto the Lord, and that is the whole issue in every sense of the word. And that brings us down now through to the last part of Colossians, which will begin in chapter 4, verse 2. In closing, question on the passage we've been through. Paul. Okay, there has to be, question was, on all these relationships where there has to be submission or obedience or something, there obviously has to be some type of limitation on it. And I think that comes, first of all, logically, if you take the concept of authority and recognize that authority belongs only to God. However, in his program of administration, he's parceled out blocks of it. Since he's the ultimate authority, anything he parcels out is therefore limited by him. So that if you got a child parent, or if you just put parents over here and husbands over here and the master over here, is that since only God has all authority, we have to write over all of these, they are all limited. The question would be, who are they limited by? Obviously God. Then, what are those limitations? And I take it the only thing you'd go would be God's revealed limitations in His Word. In other words, He certainly wouldn't grant authority to a husband to ask someone to violate His Word. And therefore, I would take it this, that each one of these is an authority in a limited box. The minute they function outside of the box, they're not an authority and should be disregarded. All right.
They've done something wrong.
In other words, you've got an authority who it's easy if what they have asked you to do is within the scope of Christian principles. That's simple. It's also simple if they come out directly, unquestionably against something that's stated in the Word. They tell you to rob a bank or something. That's simple. It's those things that are... A husband says to his wife, you may not any longer attend Bible class. What are you going to do with it? Is that clearly a violation of the verse over in Colossians that says, thou shalt attend Bible class on Wednesday? Would she, should she, all I know is, in the absence of a further thing, it's the same principle that God leaves an awful lot to the judgment of the believer. And I'd simply say, before God, you just have to use your judgment. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. That's not Charlie, you have it. Yes, you could do that. I figured your reasoning, line of reasoning would come around to something like that. Now, the first question is the authority acting within the correct limitations? If they're acting contrary to the Word of God directly, obviously you've got a clear-cut case. The problem is, in so many of those things, you don't have clear-cut cases. They're not that simple. It's a thing like, you know, the husband said, you're not going to Bible class during the week. And I said previously, and one say, if he said I couldn't go to Bible class at all, I wouldn't do it. If he just forbade one night, I would. I don't know. I'm glad I'm not a woman. You have fun?
I know it's great theoretically in terms of
the
practice, but ideally, if God has all the authority, then he can't violate the Bible class.
Sure. Oh, sure. Sure. Oh, ultimately you come back and even we consider from the standpoint of the sovereignty of God, you go to the book of Esther and you got a wicked king and corrupt and crude all the way through. Make a difference to God. Just makes a guy have a dream some night and saves the Jewish people. Basically, so many of our problems arise because we are so limited, and we sometimes just feel like if we don't manipulate the situation right, it's not going to turn out right. And the program's probably going on fairly well as far as God's concerned. He scored 90 today. Yeah. I think in the strict context, he is using that. I think the question is there a principle involved in the parable that is applicable?
Yeah.
I think the principle is there's an agreement. If there's an agreement, that's fair. If he does more, that's generosity. No, in the same sense I would take it that the kingdom has become like is your concept of the mystery phase of the kingdom. The kings have been rejected, and we're now in the Matthew 13, the mystery aspect of the kingdom, which I take it in the church age. It's the kingdom when the king's gone. What's happened now that he's been rejected? What's going to occur to the kingdom? Well, here's the progress. It's going to, just like Matthew 13, which describes things in the church of professing Christendom. The idea. Okay. Are you talking to Colossians?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, there are good masters and bad masters.
Mm-hmm.
Good employers and bad employers. A slave couldn't quit.
No.
What is an employee? There's a fine line. Is it right to quit?
Yeah. Okay, I think again, it have one of two options. Either execute the job faithfully or quit. And I don't know, those options can be, might be kind of hard. But your particular line, you might take a look at 1 Peter 2, did come up. And the thinking was, well, we can buy this thing as long as you got a good master. But what if you don't have a good one? Well, what he's going to say is that even if you don't have a good one, that still doesn't destroy the authority pattern. It's in two.
No, I agree with that. I have no problem with that. I think the question is, slave couldn't quit.
Yeah, slave couldn't quit. That's right. The only option he would have would be, of course, to suffer consequences if he felt the pressure too great. Yeah, the 2:18, servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the crooked. And it doesn't mean that you execute their crooked wishes. It means that their moral character doesn't destroy authority. Yeah. No, a servant didn't. A servant didn't have any option to quit. It was just very difficult. And I think it is. Yeah, there has to be a lot of it. A lot of it. You get the general principles laid out, but the discretion matters. Even in relationship to government, have we come to? By and large, I feel like I can pretty much function throughout the day, keep the laws, and not violate Scripture. But what will happen if and when, we can't do that? Still got to obey Scripture, and we'll probably suffer some consequences, which will make us the normal church again. Bob? No, I think again, that's why I said servant and master is not exactly equivalent. I mean, they're parallels. But you can't make it equivalent all the way across the board to employer-employee. Because when the employer employed you, part of the agreement was obviously understood that you may quit. Now, I guess if you got employed and signed an agreement that you would never quit, but I don't think any of us, get employed on that basis. So that, again, you'd be within your line of your requirements. Yeah. And I know this makes some tremendous problems, and I know I can say what I feel. For example, there's no way I would ever be.